All right, guys, we're live. You are on the Rickin YouTube channel, and today's topic is near and dear to my heart. One of my favorite things to talk about. We're talking about how to get insanely rich in wholesaling in 2024. And I want to give this as a precursor that so many people define richness just in money terms. I'm here to tell you, you're not even scraping the iceberg if that's what you're thinking about it. My true definition of just being rich, being wealthy, is doing what you want, when you want, and being the own manager of like your own time, and then growing and prospering each and every month and each and every year. See, if you're just going to measure people's wealth and richness by money, well, I'm going to tell you, money will never buy happiness. I know this. I've lived it. It is what it is. But I will tell you, money will buy you a lot of things. So let's talk particularly on how to do this in 2024 in wholesaling, because you guys know I'm a wholesaler at heart, and I'm just going to kind of walk you through my rules, my definitions on how to get rich. And the really cool part is I'm going to talk as if you don't have two nickels to rub together. So if you are up for it, let's just jump into it and do that, and then we'll take some questions right afterwards. So let me put it in here. So if you are new to this group, go over to freewholesaling.com. Not only learn how to get your first deal for free, I'll teach you how to get to your first 100K. And here's the really cool part. It's all 100% free, and I want you to check it out. So that being that, let's jump into it. So the first rule of becoming just filthy rich in wholesaling, and most people forget this one. You ready for this? You got to focus on doing your first wholesale deal. So many people talk, they've been going months, 6 months, a year. Some people I've met 2 and 3 years. And you got to kind of look at it and go, like, how bad do you really want it? Honestly, if you truly want to become wealthy, like super rich in wholesaling, especially in 2024, you got to get out the gate and get your first deal done. And if you haven't got your first deal done, you got to ask yourself, what is it that is holding me back? What is restraining me from doing this? And I'm here to tell you, 9 times out of 10, it's everything going on in your head and you haven't trained it right and you're stuck. You should be able to do your first wholesale deal well within your first 6 months and ideally in your first 90 to maybe 120 days. But after that, it's not about how much you study, how hard you work. It's a question of, do you actually apply the principles? Do you actually go out and take the action doing the work? And I'm telling you right now, if you do not do wholesale deals, you don't have to worry about the rest of my presentation because none of it's going to work. To legitimize yourself as a wholesaler, you actually have to go out and do a deal. I get it. The first few are brutal and they're challenging. Some of you guys got it with greatest of ease, and I think that's awesome. But no matter what market you are, where you're doing this, is you got to get your first deal done. So many people are thinking 100 deals down the road. What are you going to do to get your first deal done? And that's all I would concentrate on in the very beginning. And I don't care if it takes you 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is, just get it done. Because without that, it doesn't matter what I put on the screen. You are not going to become rich without doing the deal. So I always ask people, once you've done your first deal, then we're going to turn it into 5 deals. And then after that, it's really easy to double. And then it's just a matter of following the rules to the game. So once you get that first deal, it means you're on your way to getting your first 100K in wholesaling. And 100K is like the bare minimum you really need to survive in the United States. And here's the good news. If you guys have been living on like 30, 40 grand, 100 grand will be amazing for you. But I'll be the first to tell you, 100 grand is not a lot of money anymore. The cost of goods and services and housing and gas and everything is insane. So we want to get you to your first deal to get you to your first 100K. And the first deal will easily lead to that first 100K. And I'm telling you that 100K will easily get you to $1 million in wholesaling. Let me show you how you do it. So let's talk about the rules first of all. Ready? You got to stop trying to look rich. It doesn't work. And you know exactly what I mean. You guys have heard me talk about this before. If you're out there leasing the fancy Mercedes, BMW, You're trying to impress all your friends and neighbors on the block. You're just fooling yourself. Nobody gives a crap. Nobody cares if you own it or lease it. In fact, by you leasing it, you're almost admitting it that you don't have the money for it. So the reality is, if you would just stop keeping up with the Joneses and make that sacrifice, you could leapfrog your neighbors by thousands and thousands of leaps. But we are in a world, especially in the United States, where we all want to look and act like we're rich. And the reality is most of us are broke. It's the truth, guys. I was this person for the longest time. I just wanted to look like I knew what I was doing. And the reality is when you try to keep up with the Joneses, it's just a house of cards. It's just a matter of time for the whole thing falls down, because you have got to go out and produce the revenue. And if you want to stop trying to look rich and you give that up, you replace it by, I'm going to learn how to actually get rich. And the rule to learn on how to get rich is, number one, stop trying to act like you're rich. The only person you're fooling is yourself. And once you come to that complete acceptedness, then you can progress. You see, if you can't identify what the problem is, you can't correct it. You can't fix it. And that's where the human ego gets stuck. You know, the person always wants to be right. This is me. This is how we're going to do it. You have to let that go right away. So we're going to stop trying to look rich. You're going to actually accept the fact that you need to learn on how to be rich. And here's the big one. Once you accept those, this one's easy. Make the sacrifice so now you can become rich. And what do I mean by the sacrifice? Why, all your friends are out on the fancy vacations and they're partying and everything else. You are in there doing the work. You're doing your marketing. You're finding wholesale deals. You're meeting with sellers. You are just nonstop going through your leads. You're getting your government lists and you're doing everything. You have to put in some time to do this. Guys, I buried my head to the pavement for 7 years. I didn't even look back. And honestly, the first 2 years, I had a lot of fun doing it because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But at some point, you have to make a sacrifice to get ahead. And if you're always trying to keep up with the Joneses, you're never going to make it, because eventually you will have something that falls apart. You can't keep up with payments and you're going to get exposed and it even looks worse. So don't act like you're rich. Don't try to attempt to become rich. You got to learn how to become rich. See, most people want to be rich without doing any of the learning or the journey. And that's what we call a dream. It's like a unicorn and it's never going to happen. And the sooner you understand that. So let's talk about the rules to getting there. So I can show you how to generate a ton of money in wholesaling. And I went through this journey where I learned how to generate a lot of money. I just didn't know what to do with the money. And I used my old habits to create massive problems in my life. And I want you guys to understand this. So the first thing you have to understand is you got to stop buying stupid things. You are in the prime time. Some of you guys are going through the holidays watching it, or you're coming out and you're getting the holiday bills in 2024. And I'm here to tell you, man, most of the crap you guys buy, especially during Christmas, it's useless. Now, I'm all for gifts, but a gift is just a gift. The true experience is spending time with people, getting to know them, and really making a difference in their life. Buying them a cheap gift from Costco that was most likely built in China that's going to fall apart in 3 to 6 months for some temporary pleasure, it is not going to replace you. It is not going to make someone like you that much more. I'm here to tell you, you guys got to stop spending ridiculous amount of money on gifts and everything like that. It's a waste of time. More importantly, think about the things you guys buy personally. Your fancy cars, the boats, the houses you can't afford. Like, do you really need all this stuff? Once again, if you're not trying to keep up the Joneses and you truly want to become rich, you're going to have to ask yourself some really hard questions on this, and you're just going to have to let some of it go. Now, in order for you to do that, you have to understand a couple of things. You got to understand the difference between a liability and an asset. And most people don't understand this. I know this is basic, but I'm just going to walk through it real quick. Number one, a liability. They're usually fun things, fun toys that give you temporary satisfaction, and they just give you long-term pain because you usually got big fat payments. What do I mean? Cars, boats, houses. Yes, your house is a liability. I don't give a crap what you say to me. And here's how you define a liability: anything that you have to pay out. So if you own your own home and you're writing a check to your mortgage, paying taxes, insurance, everything, it is a liability. Now, yes, you get appreciation with it and you'll get your money back when you sell it. But so many homeowners want to use their house as a piggy bank. It's usually the worst thing you can do. The only thing I give you permission to pull money out of your house is to go buy other income producing assets. And a house, a boat, a car — a house is an exception. A boat, a car, an RV, a motorcycle, all that stuff, it will get you nowhere in life. It's a fun toy, don't get me wrong, but it's going to be worth less. You're going to have to pay every month and you have to worry about it. You have to insure it and you have to title it. And for those reasons, if you keep buying liabilities like I have up on my screen here, you will never get ahead. The reality is you should be buying a liability. If you want to buy a liability, say you want to buy a really nice car or boat, it should be able to write one check. It doesn't even hurt you or your business. And it's a joy to buy it. If you are stretching every dime you got to get it, most likely it's not a good fit for you anyways. And honestly, if you're going to make the sacrifice, remember, it's going to require sacrifices to get rich, especially in wholesaling. It's no different than any other business. So liabilities, if you're concerned, if you are paying somebody monthly or you're paying to upkeep it, anything like that, and it does not produce income, it's a liability. You better start looking at your liabilities real carefully, because these things will wipe your cash flow out and it doesn't allow you to buy things that actually make you rich. Now, on the opposite side, assets. Assets pay you. It's an asset if it pays you, period. End of story. You can't redefine this. I've tried it every which way. I know somebody goes, well, my house, it's really an asset. No, it's not. Unless you're renting it out and someone's paying you, it's a liability. Let me ask you this. You could go buy the same small trailer and pay $1,200 a month when you guys are paying your $3,500 mortgage. It is a luxury item. It is a liability. An asset pays you. So once you understand that and you understand how your cash goes in and out of your account, if you really live on a tight budget and you generate cash through wholesaling, you have to make a decision. If you keep buying the same dumb crap you did in the past, like I did, it doesn't matter how much money you make, you will never become rich because you'll never keep it. Remember, money rewards those that actually take care of it. So if you reinvest it in something that grows over time and makes more money, you'll even be happier. Trust me, you've got to make the sacrifice, guys. So now here's my bonus asset. You ready for this? Any asset you buy and it goes up in value. So if I buy, say, a multifamily, say I bought a duplex and each side's paying me $2,000 a month, $4,000. And at the end of the year, I got $20,000 extra dollars. And here's the really cool part. It tends to go up in value. It appreciates. Now the question, does it appreciate or does inflation just destroy the value of the dollar? It doesn't really matter. This is a huge win-win. And this right here, guys, is one of the single functions of how you really get financially free, especially with wholesaling. You see, once I could show you how to generate $100,000, I'll show you how to do that 10 times over. It's easy to put in $1 million. The question is, are you going to buy income-producing assets or are you going to buy liabilities that wipe you out? One of the easiest things you do is you guys are going to find single-family homes or even some multis that people will give you incredible terms on. They make it super simple. These are great assets to buy because you get them at such a low, low cost and you rent them out for positive cash flow. You collect 10, 15, 20 of these, amazing things will happen in your life. And I'm here to tell you, assets that you can buy that can appreciate, that actually pay you, if you can collect these over the years, especially if you're young and you started, amazing things can happen in your life. It's honestly, it is hard not to become rich by buying assets like that. Now, the problem is we take that, say you just take that $100,000 you earn, and after you pay your taxes, you buy a sports car, you take a trip to, Jamaica, and then you got to start all over again. And that's the problem. You have to make the sacrifices to get ahead. Remember, when everybody is out there balling, you've got to be packing the cash away and making it work. Now, I'm going to put out a controversial thing here. This is not 100% accurate, but it's about 95% accurate because I do have people that work that actually are very wealthy, but they have a very specialized skill set and they work for a great company. Unfortunately, that is the exception and not the rule. The reality is you're not going to become rich working for others. I'm sorry. You can love your job. And honestly, if you're okay with that, I'm okay with it too. But if you want to be completely free, financially free, physically free, freedom of your time, controlling everything when you start and stop work. If you work for somebody else, there are rare exceptions. If you run a sales floor for a great company, you can be a millionaire working for the right employer with the right skill set. But honestly, that's called an intrapreneur. Most of you guys are going to wind up being entrepreneurs. You're going to wind up doing the wholesaling thing. So if you're working for someone else, I just want you to understand you're working on their dreams, not yours. I don't knock it because I did it for a long time, but the reality is the odds of you getting rich, because the other part you got to learn is the US tax code. And you can get the exact same benefits as a corporation as a wholesaler. So what if I showed you, I could show you how to make a first 100K in your first year and you kept close to 100% of that money, as opposed to being a W-2 employee where you're going to pay between 21, 25% of that. That's like getting a 25% pay increase on top of it. You see, entrepreneurs, good ones that run their own businesses, read the rules, especially on taxes. Most W-2 employees just go, okay, how much do I pay? Honestly, as a W-2 employee, you are penalized the most in the US tax system. End of story. I can show it to you a million times over. And I love when people say, well, so-and-so, they paid zero in taxes. It means they read the rules and they made the appropriate investments in the US system, being payroll, development, purchasing assets, and then the US tax system rewards you for it. So when you hear people that like didn't pay their taxes, unless they completely cheated it, but if you have enough depreciation, you buy enough real estate, you have enough employees, you have enough fixed assets, you can offset most of your income. Why? Because you read the rules. I didn't write the rules to the US tax codes. Go speak to your politicians. They're the ones who write it and they're the ones constantly changing it. And it's our job, your job, to understand it so you can take full advantage of it. So remember, if you're paid 100K as a W-2 employee, you take that money and then basically you got to pay roughly, just say 24% of that. So 24 grand goes right out the door. And then keep in mind, you are limited by what your employer provides as a 401k. Most 401ks are complete crap. Did you know you can put away up to 60K a year in a 401k? The problem is you got to own the corporation to be able to do that. Can you imagine if you could set 62 grand aside a year? I'm not a CPA, but every December I take a huge deduction and put it in my 401k. That's money. Now you're going to have to pay taxes down the road on it, but like, why not offset your income, especially when it's high? Guys, you got to read the rules. And that's the biggest secret that I find with people who become independently wealthy. They learn to read the rules or they have people help them figure out the rules. So let's talk about specifically what rich people acquire first. These are the most important ones, and they're not out buying cars and fancy stuffs. They're out getting the first thing. So the first thing I always going to say is going to be rental properties. Why? Because you're going to have some deals that come across your desk. You might be able to get some creative financing, or they're very, very low purchase prices. These are great properties to just hopefully get cleaned up. And I don't want you to fully rehab them and generate. Let me give an example. I own trailers. Yeah, I've never been excited about them. I buy them anywhere from 10 to 25 grand, but they rent out for $1,700 a month now. When I first bought them, they only rented for $300 because I was patient. I made the sacrifice. Those go in my account every month. And honestly, they're very, very simple to keep running. The taxes are low on them. The insurance is low on them. And honestly, they beat the hell out of any of my regular single family houses because they generate the most cash flow. They are not the sexiest thing, but they work really, really well. What do other rich people do? They buy businesses. So you as a wholesaler are going to create a business. And if you create wholesaling correctly, you can run it forever. You see, the pipe dream of selling a wholesaling business, that's complete BS. You are the asset to your company. And the assets that it produces, like rental houses, multifamilies, apartments, anything like that, That is the outcome of the business. Now, you don't, everybody's so obsessed with trying to flip their business. And I'm here to tell you, you can produce assets in wholesaling. My wholesaling's worked so well. I've been doing it over 20 years now. I run it as a business. I'm just not in it every day. I know exactly what needs to be done. I know the cost of running the business, and I know the key players that it needs. Remember, I'm not the guy who makes the most money in wholesaling. I never claim to be, but I will promise you, I'm probably one of the richest guys you ever meet wholesaling. Why? Because I do what I want, when I want. I got plenty of money to do whatever I want. And that alone makes me a dangerous person. I love this business. So you can always run your wholesaling business. Here's the caveat. You're not going to sell your wholesaling business. I'm so tired of people telling, oh, I sold my business for 8-9 figures. It's never been happened. Guys, I've looked at a ton of wholesaling businesses. They're only as good as the operator and the employees of it. And honestly, if you have a great producing business, you can bring in a key employee and get yourself out of the way and have them run it. And that's what I had Zach did when I initially broke out with several other employees. And now I still love wholesaling. I'm like, I'm still involved in it. I just don't need to be there every day. So your business you're going to own is going to be your wholesaling, because once you get it up and producing, it'll produce cash forever. Why would you walk away from it? The only people that walk away from wholesaling businesses are the ones that quit it. And it means it wasn't really making any money, and that's why they stopped doing it. Just saying. Some of the other stuff's pretty straightforward. It's the stock market's a big one, especially if you're young, you got a lot of time. It's so easy to invest in stuff. And honestly, I like to buy stocks. I like to have them go up over time. I hate that I don't really have control over everything. You can't time the market. You're never going to beat the market. So just join the damn thing. Pick out the stocks you think have the best, or just do a growth fund or anything like that. If you guys need ideas for that, QQQ, ARK, a lot of that stuff. But like an S&P 500, like a Vanguard fund. I'm not a financial advisor, but honestly, I've never really got hurt with stocks. So the key with stocks is you got to own them for a few years, so in case there's a dip, but they always come back. I've been doing this a long time, guys. There was only about a 2 or 3 year period where it got a little bit like nerve wracking, but for the most part, if you're in it for the long haul, 5 to 10 years, don't ever think you can time the market. Anybody tell you they can time the market, I promise you they got killed. It's impossible. You can't do it. And my favorite are Forex people. Well, you can time the trading. I go, okay. Just show me your wins and never show me the losses, and we can sit here and sell the story all day. The reality is you're selling an MLM. Most Forexes are. But that's not my, I don't do MLMs. They're just not my cup of tea. I'm not saying they don't work. I don't like how they're sold. So the last thing that rich people invest first, ready? And so you notice I said rental properties, businesses, stock market, and they investing in people. When they find a good person that can help their business grow and help them get things done, they go all in on them and they invest hard on them. And it's not only with salaries and monies. They teach, they mentor, and they do everything. A lot of things like I do with you guys. And I'm just telling you, these are the early things. And I want you to understand this. So investing in people, stock market, businesses, which are going to be your wholesaling, and pick up a few rental properties. By you doing the rental properties, keeping your business producing cash flow, taking some of your wins and divesting in the stock market, and then finding people to help you grow, I'm telling you guys, when you become super rich, you can buy whatever you want, because then you've got to try to get rid of money and it's a pain in the butt. But I'm here to tell you is if you're still using your regular CPA, the one you started out when you started your business or you graduated high school, you have not pushed your wholesaling business. I've been through so many CPAs as my businesses grow. So as of right now, I'm at like 9+ businesses. And the reason is you got to keep up all the paperwork, all the accounting, and you need CPAs to help you on how to read the tax code and everything like that, because I can't ever figure it out on my own. And then 2 months ago, we figured out what our tax liability is, already made our estimated payments. And then we do investments. We blow up the 401ks, max them out to the best of our ability. You can do SEPs. IRAs are going to be on your own. There's so many things you can do with a corporation. So most of you guys start out with LLCs and that's fine. But I'm telling you, as you get very good in wholesaling, you're going to want to switch it over to corporation and take advantage of every deduction that a regular corporation takes. Did you know that you can take trips? You can take retreats. You can spend 10, 20, 30 grand. As long as you're doing business and you're discussing business, That's normal money that a W-2 wage earner would have to pay after taxes. As a business owner, you have the ability to actually deduct that expense while you operate your business. Now, you have to do it legally, consult your CPAs on how to do it. But guys, just by being a wholesaler to get you to 100 grand, I can save you 50% of the expenses you normally pay as a W-2 employee. Why? Because you can pay for most of your stuff with pre-tax dollars versus after-tax dollars. But I didn't want to go too deep on this one because, to be honest with you, my goal is always to get you focused and started on wholesaling. But the reality is these are the basic things that you have to do. And I will tell you, I can't get this through your head. You're going to have to make a sacrifice. I've never met anybody rich outside of trust fund babies that actually had everything given to them. They actually all made a sacrifice, every one of them. Go down the line. I know there's exceptions. People are born with money. Those people usually never keep the money because they don't understand money. But I'm telling you, you're going to have to make a sacrifice to learn how to become rich. And for God's sakes, please stop trying to look rich. Now, let me jump over and what's up, guys? Okay, let's take some questions. Let's see. You guys pretty much answer everything. What's up, Jack? How you doing? Okay, I put the StreamYard link up there for you. And you guys pretty much answered all your questions. So here's a good one. Shadow, you're asking about wholesaling in Illinois. Here's what I'm telling you. Read your state statutes. You read them. Don't let me read them. Don't let Zach read them. You are in a challenging state when you do pass one. So you're going to have to make a decision if you need to do license. You can also consider doing virtual wholesaling. Illinois only is one of those restrictive states. But guys, here's the really cool part. There's only one or two states that restrict you. For the most part, everything else is wide open. So if you don't want to do business there or you think they're going to hassle you, you can always do virtual wholesaling, or worse, just go get your license and move on with it. I'm not a big fan of people getting their licenses, but some states force it and you're stuck with it. So what's up, Heather? She's closing her fourth deal tomorrow morning. That is awesome. I would love to hear more about it. So if you guys want to hop on, Brady, let's go. Okay. So you guys kind of know the rules here, how we do this. So let me jump on. Remember, guys, no complaining on this thing. The last thing you ever want me to do is start complaining to me, because I'm going to turn it back on you and I'm going to do it in a positive freaking way. So let's see here. Victor, what's going on, man?
Hi there. How you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Good. Just got out of the shower, so.
Okay. Hopefully you put some clothes on.
Yeah.
What's going on, man? What can I help you out with?
A couple of things, actually. Question on the texting for probates. I've been using Zach's method, well, your guys' method, on texting, doing 5 texts per hour. I've used Bard to give me different scripts, varied scripts. Uh-huh. And what I've been doing is doing screenshots from Deal Machine of those properties and sending those. Would that be good to use on probates?
I wouldn't text probates. It's kind of a waste.
Okay.
Just being honest with you. It's you're better off just cold calling a probate. They're not very receptive to a text. We've tried it. It sucks.
Gotcha.
Okay. You could be the person that breaks the mold, but you have to get on the phone with someone and see if they're willing to sell the property first. And most of them, they just don't respond well to text. They do respond well to mail, but it's very slow. So the best way to connect with anyone to probate is going to be a cold call or a letter. And door knocking doesn't really work because they're not there. Reverse driving for dollars doesn't work. And then texting, they're not a big fan of it. So I hope that helps you out. I have a lot of data behind that too. I'm just telling you, you can try it, but we haven't had any success on texting with probates.
Okay.
It's a great idea. I love the convenience of it, but it's just, it's hard. The only way you're going to get a good deal in probate is you got to connect with them personally. And unfortunately, the text doesn't really send that vibe off. And there's not enough probate leads to really make it. Now, if you had thousands of probate leads, maybe, but like when you only get a handful, you got to make them count. And so the best thing to do is pick up that phone and just call.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Another quick question. So I've got two pretty good leads. I'm doing this virtually and they're out of state owners. And I was wondering, so should I, as a precaution, should I lock the house under contract before I send a boots on the ground to take pictures?
Yes.
Okay.
And you better get it for as low as you possibly can.
Okay. Okay.
If you do it the other way, you're going to waste a lot of time.
Got it.
No, it's got to be a good deal on paper first before you even start like the next phase of the process. And the biggest challenge, are you doing it locally or virtually?
Virtually.
Yeah. So the biggest problem with the virtual is having people be honest with you of the current condition of the house and its repairs needed. That's the biggest hang up. Because people will get a contract. Oh, they get a contract for $100,000. And then you find out it needs $50,000 worth of work. And like $100,000 is not even a deal. Even $50,000 is not a deal. And that's the hardest part. So you got to find a way to kind of cut through that and try to get honesty from the seller before you even hire someone to send them out for boots on the ground, or you'll waste a lot of money and time doing that as well too. You got to try to get them to be truthful about the condition of the house, because if not, they're just going to be wasting their time.
Okay.
But a lot of people virtually think, oh my God, if he's going to pay me $100,000, I'm just going to shut my mouth. No, someone's going to look at the house. Okay. So. And then it's going to be a much lower number if I have to go through that entire process, because it costs me more time and money. So get it under contract first, then send someone out there. That also protects your deal if it's a good deal. And you can get out of the deal if it's bad.
Okay. So something that I was just kind of curious about in terms of like the contract, and I got this from reading The Art of the Deal from Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about sending a letter of intent. Is that the same thing as a purchase and sale agreement? Or is that?
Yeah, but letter of intents don't work on properties. They're too vague. And it works on a big property or commercial property, but people are looking for a contract. That's what they're really looking for from you. So you're better off just writing up, make an offer, because it just a letter of intent is designed for an asset that's going to take you 3 to 6 months to close on.
Okay, gotcha.
Wholesaling houses does not really qualify for that. So, I mean, you can do it, but it doesn't really have any teeth either. So a letter of intent is just what I intend to do, but it doesn't mean it's what I'm going to do. So it doesn't have any teeth. So we do them on apartment complexes a lot, just because I don't want to write a 25-page contract for them to kick it to the curb. So a letter of intent allows you to go, listen, I'm serious about it. How serious are you? And then it turns into a contract from there. So, but you know, some people just make verbal offers all day and they never put it in writing. It's kind of the same thing. So
okay.
I would just write the contract, because it's going to show you're serious on your side.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. There's something running through my head. So if I go about getting the property locked up under contract without looking at the inside of the property, at that point, that's where my strategy should be go for the no, yeah.
Repeat that. I didn't hear you on that one.
I'm sorry. So in terms of getting the property locked up on contract, so if I haven't seen the inside of it, or if I don't have any pictures to get an estimate on it, at that point I should just, I guess, go for the no on this one and go as low as possible and then work my way up.
Yeah. I mean, you got to get it low. Otherwise it ain't going to work. So when you're virtual, you're at more risk because you're not familiar with the area and you can't physically see the property. So you write up a contract, you want to have a contingency period to make sure it's what they say it is. And then if it's not, you either get out of the contract or you try to renegotiate it. So,
okay.
And listen, in the beginning, you're going to have a higher failure rate on virtual deals because number one, you don't know the market. Number two, you can't physically see the property. That's why you got to get it as low as possible because see if you can even make the numbers work.
Okay.
Okay.
Cool. Got it.
Okay, bud.
Awesome. Thanks.
Okay. See you, Victor. Okay. Let's keep going here. Jeremy, what's going on, man?
Hey. You started to answer my question just then.
Okay.
You're probably going to tell me to go to freewholesaling.com, but I'm going to ask anyway.
Give it a shot.
I'm on the phone. What? Well, I finally got my list that I was trying to get, my code violations. I'm coming across a lot of distressed properties, a lot of trailer parks, a lot of vacant land. And I'm struggling on how to price those, you know? Is it just go for no and start from there? And
so you're talking about vacant land. What else?
Distressed properties, too. Like Redfin will have a value for the home. Zillow will have a value. There'll be an assessment value, an appraisal value. So just go as low as I can and start from there. Is that?
Yeah, you're. I got an echo. Turn your volume down.
Let's see if it's better if I keep it away from my face.
Okay, let me hear now. It's still echoing. I don't know why. The reality is, you don't know the exact value or anything, so you have to buy stuff at a discount. So doing the go for no method just saves you a lot of time. Because if you have to sit there and try to comp and price every property, you just wind up being a realtor. So if a property's comping roughly at 200, I'm going to come in at low 100s and see where it goes. Why? Because I don't want to waste my time. Now, here's the catch. Is you have to build rapport with them and have a conversation. If you just go in with numbers, it's purely transactional and you're not going to get anywhere.
Because the gurus, they told me to go for 50% from the beginning. Is that too low?
Well, you can't get hurt on that. Most gurus, they typically teach you to overpay for every property. I don't. I'm just telling you. I'd rather you get 75 rejections and one yes, then get 50 yeses and then try to have to unwind 50 properties. And that's the problem with most wholesalers. So the idea is it depends on how long it's on the market. But if you can get a truly off-market property, your job is to try to have the seller give you their lowest price. And the best way to do that is to go for no method.
Because I'm getting traction now. I'm getting people to answer the phone and I just don't want to make a mistake.
Yeah. So, in the beginning, I used to handicap myself. So, I would take $40,000 to $50,000 off of whatever I was going to offer. And it worked.
Okay.
So, I made an offer on a property today. I was in a rush. It was a much bigger property. And I thought I was going to know. And they instantly took the offer half an hour later. And now I'm kind of running away to how I get a discount on it. I hate that.
But PropStream, if I were to pay for that, PropStream would give me a value, right?
Yeah, but I'm not going to sit. If you gave 10 people a property, they're going to give you 10 different opinions on the value.
Gotcha.
So it's going to be within 5 to 10%. So just stop guessing that last part and see how big of a discount they'll give you. And that's what's going to dictate if you move forward with the deal. Trying to buy everything 5 to 10% off is like a waste of time. You got to find people that are willing to get rid of their properties at a discount and get rid of it now. There are people out there, but they're not the normal people you and me think, like on MLS and stuff like that. So
then I'm finding land with like trailers on it, but the trailers look worthless. So, you know,
as long as they own the land, you got a shot. Trailers
are pretty much a land deal.
Yeah. You can buy the land, but the trailer's like buying a car. And I own lots of cars, which like the trailers never deal with it. They look terrible, but man, they spend out a lot of cash. And as far as vacant land, I will tell you on vacant land is because nobody really knows the value other than what they paid for it. If you can find a buyer for it that will pay a certain amount in that area, you have a tactical advantage over people with vacant land. Let me give an example. I bought 10 tracts of land, I think 3,200 each. long time ago in Bombay. And then I just got tired of paying the tax bill. I think I owned them 11 years. A guy called me up and offered me 10 grand a lot. I just took it. You know why? I go, well, I tripled my money, so I'll just take it. He sold it on top of me for like another 8 grand each lot. I didn't even care.
Jeez.
Because you know what I based my value off? What I paid for it. And they were trading 15 to 20. I just didn't care. Like, I just didn't give a crap. And that's what happens with vacant land. The key distinction with vacant land is you've got to have really good cash buyer intel for those areas. And then you can figure out what to offer.
Okay. You answered my question. Thank you. Sorry for the echo.
No, it's okay, man.
Thank you.
Later. Okay. I'm not sure why we get those echoes. It's kind of weird. So, Joel, what's going on, man?
Oh, hey, Chief. How you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
I didn't think I was going to get on.
Hey.
But
you give it a shot, so, right? What's going on, man? What can I help you out with?
I have two questions. One of them was that there was a couple of months back, you mentioned something. You were talking to somebody about their EMD, and there was kind of a situation like what I'm in right now, that the seller wants like $5,000 for me to put down on an EMD. I don't have $5,000. And what you mentioned was something that the EMD applied once the new buyer put their non-refundable.
Yeah. So here's the simple way to do it. First of all, a huge EMD is going to red flag you right off the bat. Do you understand? Like what's the total price of the property?
The property, I'm trying to get it for 130 under contract, but the property could sell, I would say, for like 305, 320, maybe. Okay. Yeah. The problem is that she had already dealt with another person. The house has been vacant for like 3 years, and she was dealing with someone else. They put like I think it was like a very minimum EMD, and then they kind of burned her. They just had her waiting. So now she's gotten savvy, and she wants a like $5,000. I told her, I was like, I can't do $5,000, but I still want it.
Which market are you in? Don't give me an address, but what market?
I'm in Hillsborough, Tampa area.
Okay, so you're telling me she wants a $5,000 EMD.
Yeah.
And how much work does the house need?
It needs quite a lot. The house has been abandoned for a couple of years, and it is literally like open to the elements. The roof is like, it's not a big area, but the roof is.
And what do you think you can sell it for?
I would say probably 160, you know.
And what are you putting it under contract for?
130.
Okay. I mean, it's not a bad deal. I mean, do you need a JV partner with it, or like, can you handle this one on your own?
I would love a JV partner, of course. You know,
how long ago is it under contract, or you're still waiting to do it?
No, I'm still waiting to do it because she's out of state. She has like bad health, and I only could talk to her once. Like I tried calling her multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, you got her under wraps and control, right?
Yeah, she'll talk to me, and then she's like, I have, you know, like an appointment or something. And then she's kind of like, she wants to sell it, but at the same time, it's like she has. That's sort of another thing. It's like I feel like she has a hope that somebody is gonna come around and like help her and like fix the house for cheap. And I'm like, but she's like, but if I sell it, she told me 180, and then she's like,
okay.
I went to the house, took pictures, and I sent it to her, and she's like, oh, it's worse than I thought. And then she went down to 150, and I'm staying at 130.
So you're confident at 130 though. That's my question. So I know Tampa. I went to school there. So and I flipped quite a bit of houses in Tampa. If you can send me an email at support@flipwithrick, and then just do me a favor and put Joel all in caps and just put Tampa. And if you can share with me an address, just say, Rick, it needs 50K or whatever you think it is.
Yeah.
I'll look it up and I'll tell you if I think I can swing it and make it done, because the deposit doesn't scare me at all. Yeah. It's just another wholesaler has burned them.
Yeah.
But if you can make a lot of money off it, the 5K is like irrelevant, but like it's pretty easy to move properties in Tampa, in my opinion. It's a very metro area.
Yeah. I got a couple of cash buyers here in Tampa, but obviously, I mean,
okay.
If I have the chance, I'll
if you send it tonight or tomorrow morning, I'll look at it. If you don't send it, like it is what it is. So
it's not under contract though. So,
well, I know, but just, I'm not going to call, okay. But I'm just going to tell you if I would JV with it with you. And so, yeah. Because support I might be able to put up the 5K for you if the deal works. So here's the other little trick. You decide not to use it to me. I'll give you both ways because I'm here to help and you'll call me back with another deal. You can write the contract and basically put a 30-day inspection period on it and have the EMD do after the inspection period on the 31st day. It works all the time.
Okay. So 30 days.
And that way you can use your, EMD. If you find your own buyer, you can just put theirs in there or you get out of the contract.
Okay. So that's the trick with the
that's it, buddy. Buyer. Like, okay. So even if you do say 15 days, you got 2 weeks to shop it around. And if they don't, then you know, you just get out of the contract. So they all don't fall for it. Just so you know, but you can make that deposit. You decide when the deposit wants to get fun. Now, most normal contracts within 3 business days, the EMDs do. That's the standard for real estate. Yeah. So. Because we're wholesalers, we do things a little bit differently.
Okay.
But either way, if you send me that email, I'll keep it extremely confidential. I just look on, I'm not going to call anyone and I'll let you know because you might need someone to fund that $5,000. But if I do it, we basically split it and I move it pretty quick. Like I'd have it done this year.
Yeah, that's fine. No, that's awesome.
So if you want, either way, it's up to you. I'm here to help you out either way. I would love to JV with you. I'm just extremely confident in Tampa as long as the numbers are in line because I don't know how much work it really needs.
The thing is that she's in Texas. So she has like a basic phone, so she can't do anything like over the phone to like sign the contract. She's like, you'll have to mail me the contract. And I was like, that's fine. I'll pay for it.
I'll help you with all that, dude. Like, but let's go. We're already the first week of December. If you want to wrap it up this year, send me that email and I'll at least give you my honest opinion and it'll be private. I'm not going to share it with anybody else because I know the numbers there. I got to make sure the rehab doesn't exceed the value of the house.
Yeah, no, I would say the rehab are probably between 50 and 70 on the high end. But
how many square feet are we talking about here?
The house roughly. Think is like 14 between 13, 12 and 14.
Is it a desirable neighborhood?
It's actually a pretty decent neighborhood. Like all the houses there like is a quiet.
So what would
area.
Be the ARV if they fix it up and put that money into it?
That's what I mean. The ARV would be between, I would say like 305 to like 320.
Send me that email. Let me take a look at it. I'll let you know if you're sitting on a crap load of money or you're sitting on a bad deal.
Okay.
And I'll keep it private. I never share anybody's stuff. That's why I'd rather you just send it an email where nobody else can look at it. And then send me any particulars about it. And then just put your phone number and your contact information on there. If it's real, I'll call you. If it's really bad, I'll just write you an email back and go, Joel, no way.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. And then the other one is, that I got the after making like 15 different phone calls and talking to like I've been to offices and everything, I got all the code violations from Pearl County, and it's like 8,000 of them.
Okay.
And I haven't been able to find the the codes list to have it scrubbed out.
You just got to ask him. Did you ask him for it?
No, it was all in there. Like the way they have it is like I got some lady's email. I sent her the email and she replied back to me. Like I went to an office that I got in there without permission. She gave me her email and then she sent me back a form and I filled out the form and she just sent it to me. And she's like, just fill out this form if you want it again. And I didn't ask. But the thing is that I was trying to set it, like upload it into, I got the deal machine and the way that is formatted, it only has the number and the street address. There's no city, state or zip code. So none of the uploads work. So it doesn't give me any address to for me to call back. So either I have to call them one by one, skip chase them one by one, or have somebody scrub it. I don't know what's the best way to do it.
Okay. Well, you're just gonna have to test it out and figure out what the best way is for you. Don't drive yourself crazy, yeah. But okay. You know how to deal with the skip tracing. You just gotta figure out how to deal with the code violation list. So,
yeah, I got. Okay, dude. And the only one I didn't get was the water shot off. But everything else, I actually got. I got fire damage, all that stuff. It's taking me months, but I got it. So
okay. But, well, send me that email if you want me to look at it, Joel.
Yeah, I'll send it to you right now. Thank
okay,
you.
I'm working tonight, so that's a good time. All right. Okay, bud. All right. I appreciate it. All right. See you. Okay. Let's see here. Chris, what's going on, man?
How are you?
Good, man. What's up?
So I've been dealing with a couple sellers that are in foreclosure. And my question is, how do you deal with them when they want to sell the house? They know they need to sell the house, but they do not want to move out. They think that they can sell it to me and then I'll rent it to them or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I want you secretly to do that for me too. There's nothing you can do. It's like you want to eat an entire cake and you don't want to gain any weight. Like it ain't going to happen. There's nothing you can do. Cause that's like unicorn, like fairy tale stuff.
Yeah.
And the only thing that's going to change that is time and circumstance. So, mm-hmm. And you got to kind of nicely rephrase it to him. I go, listen, we'd all like to do that. Like you, that's like saying, I never want to die and I don't want to pay taxes either. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want a six pack and I want to eat whatever I want. They're oxymoron statements. It's nothing more than wish list stuff. So you got to bring them back to reality a little bit without completely like hurting their feelings. And I simply say, I go, man, if I could do that, I would do it for you right away. But like, I've tried to get people to do that with my house and they won't do it. So I don't know how I'm going to do it with yours. But would you agree if you don't do anything, they're just going to take your house away anyways. And you're going to have to find another place to live and it's not going to be fun. And I just try to tell them, I go, if you do nothing, the crap's going to hit the fan if you like it or not. They don't think it's ever going to hit the fan. The biggest problem you have with people in pre-foreclosure is procrastination. And until they come to the realization, remember, your job is just to guide your sellers to get out of their own way. But think about this. A bank, a lien holder, filed a lawsuit because they were not given what they were promised on the paperwork that was notarized and done everything at the title company. And they have the audacity to ask for all their money back. How dare them, right? Like, think about it. If that was, the shoe was on the other foot, they'd do the exact same thing. They'd be probably crying and whining about. So I just go, listen, that's fine. You know, if you don't want to do anything, but like eventually the house is going to be sold, the sheriff's going to come and they're just going to kick you out one day. And I just like, I don't know how that gives you like ultimate freedom. But the problem is they're like, I'm not paying right now. Nobody's kicking me out and nothing bad is happening to me. You are correct. That's how it is right now. But the reality is you are going to be on the street. It's coming. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly when, but I know it's coming for a fact. And I try to talk to them. And if they don't want to solve that, there's only so much you can do. Typically what they do is call you back a week before the auction's going on and they expect you to pull a miracle out of your butt.
I know. I remember you talking about that. Yeah. And I want to tell these people, like, you know, a year from now or whatever it is, because in New York State, like when they set the auction date, I can't do anything.
Yeah. It's listen, you have more options and you might even get some money. But the reality is a home is just a home. A home is where your heart is, where you live, and people can get up and rebuild. Actually, they need out of the house anyways, because it's probably financially killing them. And you just got to try to get them to get the closure, but like, you can't make them do it. I'd like to give you like trick phrases, but like when they give me the unicorn one, I'm like, man, I go, I'm waiting for that one too. Let me know when you find someone, because I would love to get that. Wouldn't we all love that? Somebody pays you for your house and you just stay there and you make no payments. It's a joke.
And well, let me tell you what,
in my area, there's a lot of wholesalers that will buy that house and make that ridiculous promise. And the minute the money changes hands, it's a complete different like tune. And I'm telling you, I don't make promises I can't keep. You gotta be crazy to make a promise like that, right? Yeah, I'll buy your house and then I won't kick you out. Okay.
Yeah, I tell them, but I don't know if I'm telling them at the wrong time, because like I've had it now with two sellers that I, you know, we make contact, and then I tell them to get a good idea of what sort of an offer I can make on the house, or at least what their timeline looks like. I need to get a third party loan authorization signed.
Yeah.
I give it to them and they say, okay, I'll have it back to you Monday, whatever. And then they just don't sign it or anything. And then I try to follow up with them and they don't answer me.
Listen, it is, it's frustrating as heck with people in pre-foreclosure, but I've gotten some of my greatest deals with there. You'll do a lot of drama. You mostly deal with procrastination. And remember, your job is only to try to guide them and get them out of their own way, because they're like every other typical American, strutting their stuff. Look at this big fancy house I own. How much are you going to offer for me? If you're lucky, I'll let you buy it. And then if you're lucky, I'll let you buy it. And then I'll stay in here and live rent free. Like, so you got to kind of nicely churn it on them, and you got to turn the screw once or twice and see how they respond to you. I go, yeah, I mean, I go, I get it. Nothing's happening right now. I go, but it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen over like Christmas Eve or like New Year's, but these court actions don't go away, period. And the thing is, if they do nothing, they don't show up to one hearing, which is typical. Not only do they lose the house, they're going to get a judgment against them. And if they're upside down in the house, they could owe another $100,000. And if they have a job, they're just going to suck it right out of their paycheck. So the less a seller does when they're in any type of foreclosure, the worse the pain's going to be for them in the long run. Everything's negotiable with the bank. You can save their credit. You can get the foreclosure out of their name. You can give them a fresh start. And most importantly, you might be able to give them some money and give them dignity to leave on their own terms. If you go the bank's route, it's a lawsuit and they're just going to be ice cold about it. It's going to be nothing but lawyers and sheriff's officers. And if that's the route you want, then, you know, knock yourself out. But please don't call me at the last minute. I can't, I'm not a miracle worker. And that's kind of how I say it. And it's like, either they're like, yeah, I got it under control. Or like, who do you think you are? I'm like, I'm just telling you the truth. A lot of people in America cannot accept the truth, but like, there's only so much you can do with people. So that person, 95% of the time, they'll call you a week or two before their auction. And then they want like some crazy number. And like, nah, there's, I go, I'm not doing this. Like I already told you, I am not wasting my time. I gave you an offer. It works. It takes a little bit of time to work. But if you're going to procrastinate, sit there for 18 months and then call me right before they're kicking you out, I know there's no money left in it. I know you're not going to leave me any options. And the reality is they've used all their options in what we call procrastination. So don't spend a lot of time with them when they get like that. There's only so much you can do. The ones that freak out in the beginning and get it, those are the ones you want to work with. Once they get past 5-6 months, it winds up being 12 to 18 months every time. So I got three people right now. They own like 30 grand of back payments. I'm like, there's nothing I can do. They go, just make up the back payments and then give me 10 grand. I go, I don't have 10 grand to give you. You lost that 12 months ago. You've already used it. You live there for free. So don't spend a lot of energy on it. It's just not worth it, Chris. I'm going to be honest with you.
Okay.
Even though you know they need it, like, but I can't make them do it. And if you can get them to call you back in a reasonable time before it's scheduled for auction, you got a shot. But a lot of these people think they're going to walk away with hundreds of thousands of dollars the day before the foreclosure sale, and it's never going to work out that way.
No.
And even if they get an overage through the county site on the sale, it takes them years to get the money back. I've been through it so many times. So that's the downside of pre-foreclosures, guys. You deal with... I'm not going to say crazy people, but they get delusional. But like, keep in mind, these are typically people who bought the house with like 1 or 2% down. And after 6 months, they couldn't make the payment anymore. And like on those type of deals, once they miss 5 or 6 payments, there's really no money ever left in the house anyways. So what's the point, right? That's how I look at it. So I like them. You just, you're going to see more and more pre-foreclosures, guys. They're coming. People are running out of money, and most of the money is tied up in people's houses, and they think they can hold on forever with their low interest rates. But eventually the average mortgage turns over every 5 years. So we're we're approaching year three of these really low mortgages. They're all going to start. People are going to want their cash out of their house. So they have to sell them or refinance them, one or the other. So just keep your eyes out on it. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Okay, man. See you. Pre-foreclosures, man. Like my favorite. So. Okay, Junior. I see you waving. Better bring the heat. Okay. What's going on, man?
All right. For everything you're doing, first of all. So this is the deal. I came across a probate. I sent them a letter, and I also did call them. But she first responded to me. Her first response to me was saying, yes, I'm willing to sell the house. Contact my attorney. So I tried to message her a bit. I was able to get her on the phone. Okay. Long story short, it's in North Florida. She gave me an asking price. She gave me an asking price between 85 and 100. There are six different siblings. And for the most part, it seems like they're all in agreement to sell it, or the ones that are trying to lead the probate to sell it. Like once they have the money, everyone will sign it. So I did go through the house. I took pictures, took a video. I did what you said. I built rapport with the sibling that lives in the house, but that's not the sibling who's a PR. So the sibling who's a PR said, so originally I said, I don't have as much experience, but based on what I see, this looks like 85 might be fair. But I'm going to send this to my partner who has a lot more experience. I'm going to send him the pictures and videos, and then he's going to let me know if that's a good deal or not. But I said my partner was more hoping for something in the mid-70s or low 80s. She said that I have to make an offer to her attorney. So when I tried to do the contract with her, she said, since she doesn't know anything about it and there's five other siblings, that I have to make an offer to the attorney. So I'm just wondering what the best way to go about this is.
So what's the house worth?
So I've never done a wholesale. This will be my first deal. So based on what I'm doing with comps, it looks like I did see one house in the neighborhood sell for, I think, under 100, but it looks like the house is worth like 120, 130, like anywhere between like 125 to the mid 130s.
Okay.
So it's a 4-bedroom, 1.5 bathroom. It's in decent condition.
So what do you think about offering on it?
Since she did say 85 to 100, I told her that I think 85 is fair. So given the fact that there are five other siblings and the attorney, I'm thinking it might be safe to offer 85. But I got kind of nervous and wasn't sure what to do when she mentioned, like when she was still very firm on going, making an offer to the attorney. Because I did hear that he's...
Well... So let me tell you how this works, and then I'll give you a play with it. Number one, the attorney just oversees the probate.
Okay.
Probate is when somebody passes away and they wrap up their financial affairs, specifically with any type of equity ownerships, real estate, cars, boats, RVs, houses, and bank accounts, stocks, and stuff like that. So a probate, a lawyer handles all that stuff that goes in there. The biggest asset most people own is their house.
Right.
Okay. It is 100% up to the PR, and they can use the other heirs, the beneficiaries, to come up with a price of what they need for that house. It's completely up to them. The attorney has no say in it. Attorney's job is about doing legal paperwork. It's not about, is this a fair offer or not? And when an attorney sticks their nose in it, it pisses me off because they're guessing. They have no idea. Now, some of these houses need work. It just depends. If all five heirs are in agreement and they want to kind of get their money fast, a wholesaler is a great option. These are houses that typically need work. When the heirs are just price sensitive, everything's about money, and the house is in decent shape, and there's an attorney involved, you have a very slim shot of getting it. I'm just giving you the facts of it. So you have to respect the attorney, but I'm just letting you know the attorney doesn't say yes or no to the offer. They can say yes or no to the paperwork, but they never say yes or no to the offer. And number two, knowing you have an attorney involved, you want to use a state-approved contract. So since you're in Florida, you want to use what they call a FAR bar contract. If you don't, they'll never accept your offer.
You said a FAR bar contract?
Yeah, you can find them online. And as is FAR bar, it's like between 5 and 10 pages. Guys, it does the exact same thing as our wholesale contract. It's just fancier. It's got every what-if scenario involved in there. So you make it assignable. You write down your offer price. You put in a legitimate title company and make it look as official as possible. And then put in the offer and see what she says. But it's up to the PR to sign the contract. And a responsible PR will talk to their heirs. It's not the attorney's job to tell them what to get for it. You just want to make sure the paperwork's legal and it's all above board. So since you're using a legitimate title company, that's not an issue with you. So you can write the offer, but it's up to the PR. And what the PR usually does is go back and talk to the other heirs. Are you okay, guys? 85, we're going to split it 5 ways. Here's what you would get. And they're like, yes or no.
Okay.
And that's it. The attorney, she needs to sign the contract when it's all said and done. So she probably wants her attorney to review the paperwork. And that's where you need to submit a FAR bar contract. And just go ahead and put it in there for 85 and see what happens.
Okay.
Okay? She is the decision maker, though. So in a perfect probate, if you can work with the decision maker and come up with an agreement and then give it to the attorney, you got a 98% probability of having it go through. When you have to go through the attorney for everything, it can be a real pain in the ass. And that's, you just got to know that. So make sure you give them a FAR bar contract.
Okay.
It's still a purchase and sales of contract. It's just got a lot more like words in it. Okay. That's it.
All right. Now I wanted to JV my first deal with you guys. Is this something that I should send for you to look at? Are you interested in doing that?
Say it again.
I wanted to JV my very first deal with you and Zach. So is this something that you might be interested in? But
there's got to be some cash in there. So we got to see what it's going to sell for. So if you want, you can, why don't you see if she's even interested in the 85, because you might be wasting your breath on this. I mean, you're at 50-50 at best. Once they mix in an attorney up there, I just want you to know, it's not the attorney's job to sign any of this. They just look it over. So at the end of the day, you got a reminder. I'm like, hey, it's your decision. Is this good for you? And is it good for your heirs? And then if you're okay with that, then we can just have the attorney review the paperwork. What you don't want to have the attorney do is decide if the offer is the right amount or not, because that's not in the attorney's wheelhouse. So I always focus on the seller, which is the PR. Right. Are you okay with this 85,000? I get having the paperwork reviewed by the attorney, and I think that's a good move. But if she wants to get back to you, I'm like, why don't you discuss it with your heirs and see if 85 will work? It's a no hassle deal. It'll close a pretty quick time. And that way you don't have to deal with the house anymore. And you can disperse the money amongst the 5 heirs. Just try that and see where it goes.
Because she's the one that said 85 to 100. She's the first. That was her number. She said that was.
Just do 85 and see what happens.
Okay. But when I did say that's fair, she just like run it to the attorney. So that kind of made me.
No, I know. But listen, if you're okay, I'm going to go ahead and submit. But have you, I would say, listen, have you discussed it over with your heirs? Because I don't want to waste time writing contracts if they want 400 grand for the property. And that happens a lot with heirs, by the way.
Okay.
It's not costing them any money. They might as well just throw it out there. So do the 85. Just say, listen, can you just check with your heirs? And just keep reminding her the decision is yours. Remember, the job of the PR, they're the responsible party. And they have to disseminate the information to the heirs. And if they're all in agreement, because here's what happens. The PR signs the contract because they're legitimate. And then when you go to the closing table, all 5 heirs have to sign all the paperwork. So you want to like make sure she's tested it, that they're okay with it. And 9 times out of 10, remember, the PR is the person who has to shop the deal around. They got to show investors and realtors the property. They do all the work and they don't get paid anymore. So if they get a no hassle deal that like they don't have to do a ton of work with, they're usually very open to it in the beginning. And that's why I like working with probates. So make it for 85. Just tell her, I tell you what, check with your heirs. And if your heirs are okay with that, then once you put the 85, you can have the lawyer review it. And then I remind the lawyer, I spoke to Sally. She spoke to the five heirs. They're completely fine with the $85,000. I went ahead and put it in a far bar contract. Let me know what you think. And he's going to come back and tell you to make stupid changes. Get ready for it.
Okay.
And get under contract and reach out to me. If it's a good deal, we can partner up on it. But there's got to be some money in it, okay?
Okay. So when I go to support at Flip with Rick or
– Yeah, support at Flip with Rick. Just do that. But you got to get it under contract first.
Okay. All right.
Thank okay?
For your help.
Okay, no problem.
Be back for me soon. Thank you.
Okay. God, I'm losing my voice here. Okay. What's up, Jay?
Rick, what's going on? How you doing?
What's going on, man?
Nothing much. Just working here. I was doing some cold calling.
Okay. Am I going to listen in with you or what do you want to do?
Actually, no. I was just, you know, taking advantage of my time. I got a couple questions.
Okay,
I was going over the probate 3.0 you got. So I don't have Excel. I don't have that. So I use Google Sheets. And I was wondering, do you know if I can do that mail merge hack on the Google Sheets?
Probably not. Google Sheets is a whole different world.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to learn how to do it. And just, you're going to have to write down instructions on how to do it. Google Sheets is very sensitive on like some other stuff. So remember, they can't exactly, listen, let's all be honest. Google Sheets is just a knockoff of Excel, of Microsoft's product. So they can't duplicate everything by law. So they make just a couple changes. Mm-hmm. And like, even when you do Excel in iOS and Macs, it's a pain in the ass. Like they're all different and it just drives me nuts. So no, I'm not going to sit there and memorize all of them. So you figure it out, write it and like keep it with yourself because that's the problem when you go in between all those. If you stay in Google Sheets, you're usually fine. But the minute you got to take it out and do something inside of like a Mac or like an Android PC, it's a freaking nightmare, man. So
yeah.
Okay. Some of the Google Sheet stuff, like when I'm working online, it's so convenient because I don't have to keep downloading and uploading. But the downside is like a lot of the keys are extremely different.
Yeah.
And it looks just like an Excel sheet. So it drives you nuts.
Yeah. I mean, I can ask a couple people I know that are a little bit more tech savvy to see if there is a way. But if not, I could look into using Excel.
Yeah, no, you just got to kind of figure it out. There's usually some YouTube videos that can help you out with it. But I'm not the guy to answer that one. Trust me. Yeah. I hire everyone to like do all that crap with me. So,
okay. So I spoke to Title as well today, and they said that they don't actually see the value in me hiring a probate lawyer based off of her experience. Because I know I was going over your information, and usually you said, you know, the family would hire their petitioning lawyer. And usually if they mention their lawyer, you can bring up yours and it helps with credibility. She said that the attorney she recommended probably wouldn't be available to just last minute help with something like that because they're so busy. So they would likely want to be on a retainer. But she did say that she could communicate with the petitioning lawyer if she needs to. Yeah. She has 30 years of experience.
So the idea is you don't need to technically meet with a probate lawyer. As you get into this more and you do a few probates, you're going to run across probate attorneys. Like, trust me, you can't avoid them. And the only time they pay attention to you is in a closing room. So if I know there's going to be a probate attorney there, I'll show up just to network with them. Because you're never going to get through the receptionist. You're never going to get through their front office. So that's the time to do it. And then also a lot of attorneys, even probate attorneys, own title companies.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they'll give you legal advice just to try to get a deal in their pipeline. So you're going to find some probate attorneys are very, very difficult. They're extremely controlling. And they're just going to tell you how the way it is. Even though I can show them a statute, I'm like, you're literally breaking the law. Like, nope, this is how we do it. When I get it very difficult, then I have another attorney call them and go, listen, just let you know, I work with this title company. I know you're dealing with Mr. Ginn. You told him you couldn't do this. You know, you can't like say that. And if you're going to stick to your guns, we're going to have to reach out to other people and you're not going to like it. And I can't do that. Another attorney is like, okay, like I'm not going to play around anymore. And that's the only time you ever bring them in. You understand a probate attorney is only needed when the person needs to get a PR because you're not you're just the buyer. So as long as you're getting clear title and you're getting what you got promised from the seller, I could give I give a rat's ass what the probate attorney says. But the only time is after you do it after a while, you'll start to recognize when people lie to you and that everyone thinks you're stupid. Like I love when people go, somebody told me the other day on a live, actually I listened to someone else live that they go, you can't buy a probate until the probate's closed and done. Okay. That's why you suck at wholesaling. I don't know what else to tell you. Like go do something else because if you that's your theory, I have over 200 properties to my credit. Do you think I'm lying the whole time? Like, trust me. You can do it. You've got to make some maneuvers. But probate is a wide envelope that pulls all the assets in. The biggest one's real estate, and they've already written in laws that if you want to liquidate it so it doesn't eat the estate up, you can do it. You just got to file for a motion. Attorneys don't want to do that because they want to get paid for every piece of paper they file. So what do? They lie. You can't do it. You can't sell it till it gets out. When I get that, that's when I have, if I know a probate attorney, I go, can you do me a solid, help me out? Attorneys only talk to other attorneys. So the title company is correct because they will communicate with that person and then they'll tell you if you're a problem. So you don't need it on the first few deals you do, but when you get 15, 20 down the pipeline, it's nice to have someone call an attorney and tell them they're wrong because if I tell them or the title company tells them, they don't care. When another attorney peer-to-peer tells them you're an idiot, they start to get a little bit concerned.
Okay.
So that's the only time, I ever use them. Like, but I tell you, I tell attorneys all the time, just last week, I told them, I go, that's the biggest crock of crap I've ever heard in my life. Like, show me a statute says we have to do that. Well, it's complicated. You're not a lawyer. I go, I'm not a lawyer, but I got to tell you, I've been doing this a long time. I've never heard of the scam you're doing. I go, why don't I have my lawyer call you and you can explain it and we can document it. That way we can tell the judge what's going on. And like, that's it. So, by the way, I had a lawyer once disbarred because they were so crazy what they wanted the seller to do. They kept asking for $15,000 payments for just a regular old probate. And laws. You can only charge so much. And if you can prove in the court that they're abusing their clients, you can get them disbarred. It's not my job to do it. But I had one client, I had to wait 2 years. We actually had to file a motion to get them kicked off the case. And then I know they had a hearing to disbar them. I'm not part of that, but they just submit the documentation and the judge submits it. So I'm not a lawyer. I'm just telling you, if you ever want to tell your lawyer they're wrong, only another lawyer can tell them they're wrong. Just not like when it comes to a female, only another female can tell them they're wrong. That's like, you can't, like sometimes people just won't listen to you. So the only way I want you to use a probate attorney is if you got to call someone to the plate. And that's the only time I've ever got them like, oh crap. Like they know what I'm doing.
Gotcha.
And the lawyer goes, I know what you're doing. It ain't going to work. And if you want to keep documenting it, I'll just give it to the judge. Like, are you going to accept this offer and get this deal closed? Or are you just going to keep playing games? And that's, you understand that comes completely different from an attorney as opposed to an investor or even a title company.
Of course. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I do have someone in my back pocket then. So one more question. I don't want to take too much of your time. I was watching other videos from you and you were kind of giving different answers as far as how often you should pull certain lists. So when it came to a generalized statement, code violation, you said, I think it was monthly, but then
monthly because.
But you said code violation specifically, I heard you say quarterly. So for code violations, maybe water shutoffs, pre-foreclosures,
so probates. Here's the deal. You can't pull every list every month. So it depends on what your concentration is. If I have one list I could pull every month, it'd be code violations. It's not because I'm trying to create a crap load of more work for me. It's because I'm trying to beat every other wholesaler and realtor to the newest, freshest leads coming out. That's it.
Right.
So because if I pull it quarterly, it's much more convenient. But than three quarters of the people have already been reached out at least one time on that list. And so you lose that element of the advantage on that. Now, when it comes to some of the other lists, they don't even make sense to pull like every month. And some of the lists are so small, like the fire damage. I mean, I know people do it every week. I mean, we do probates twice a week. So it just depends on what you're attacking and like how much resources you have to pull it yourself. Because most of us are one person operators and like there's only so much you can humanly do. So in a perfect world, I would pull code violations once a month. But if I pulled like pre-probates on PropStream, I'd only do it once a quarter because most of them are duplicates. How do I know that? It's just over time. You see data after a while and you can compare two different CSV files and go, crap, that thing's 85% the exact same it was last time, only a 15% change. Is it really worth doing all this? And that's
okay.
And depending on where you are in your wholesaling career, like if you're desperate trying to get a deal on your first time, just rip through the list and go crazy. After a while, you'll settle down and go, man, I can't keep pulling the probate list every day. I used to do it every day.
I see.
I was like, why do you do it? Because I wanted to beat all my competitors. That's it.
Okay.
But I drive myself nuts. And you just like the tax delinquencies, you pull it every month. It's the exact same list. It doesn't, it only changes once a year.
So once a year, you recommend doing that one?
That's it. So find out when they post it. Like, so in Florida, our taxes are, they start to do in November. And I think you have till the end of March to pay it. And then after that, it goes to a tax certificate sale. And then you go on the delinquency tax roll. And then I pull it out. There's 26,000 people on it. And I sort through it. And I work through it over 3 to 6 months.
Okay.
Guess what? If you pull it next month, it's the exact same list. The next month, the exact same list. It might change about every 3 or 4, but you know, occasionally properties get sold. But once it gets sold, you just strike it off your list. You don't need to work it. And you just, you got to figure a rotation that works best for you. Anytime you can beat somebody on getting to the lead first, it's wildly advantageous. The question is, do you have enough manpower or do you have enough stamina to do that? It's not as easy as it sounds. Like it's a lot of work, but code violation hands down. I'm looking for the freshest crap to hit that list.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's 5,000 deep. There's always like 20 or 30 new ones on there. And they are like, whoever gets to them first and strikes up a conversation usually wins, period.
Okay. Yeah. So, I would want to know what you would recommend for what I'm targeting. I'm doing code violations, the water shutoffs, the pre-foreclosures, and I do the driving for dollars. So that's different. Yeah. And I'm going to be doing probates as well. So what do you think I'm doing? I mean, I could do it every month for all of them, but probates I could do
twice a week. It's up to you. So my recommendation is the probates, depending if you got to go in person or online.
Online. I had to go in person to get.
Like, you got to pull them weekly. Otherwise, you do not. If you try to bot it, like you try to get the last 90 days, it's a huge waste of your time. Basically, in my experience, whoever can connect with them first, that's open the selling, they usually get the deal. But some of it's timing, being in the right place at the right time. So the more often you pull it, the more you increase your chances. I'm telling you, I went for probably a 2-year period. I pulled them every day, Monday through Friday. But then we settled in and did them. We do them twice a week now, but we run a lot of counties. We don't have a choice. That's what it takes to get ahead of it. So number two is the code violations monthly, the water, just pull as often as you can as they'll let you do it. And on the fire damage, you know, once or twice a month, it depends. A lot of them are really small quantities, so it's not like a big deal. And remember, you got to be careful because if you beat the crap out of the people giving you the list and you annoy them, they'll just cut you off. So like you got to go with their tolerance level too if you're getting them in person.
Which is so I got lucky with the code violations, probates, and the water shutoffs, and even pre-foreclosures is different. But with those three, I can actually access them online.
Okay.
So I kind of lucked out. Yeah.
You got it. So you just you do it. And then, which we'll start to notice patterns. And that's how we started doing, we do probates twice a week, just because if we do it once a week, our leads cut in half. So it's somewhat of a time and you start to see patterns after a while and you're like, okay. And the thing is every other county is different. So to say one county does it this way and one does it that way, you got to be able to like mine through the data and figure it out. But once you lick one list and you get it figured out, then you look at the other one, because sometimes some lists just don't work. And if you can't get a deal off a list in 1 year, stop doing it. It just doesn't work. And this does happen, guys. It is the truth of wholesaling. But you never know until you try. So you got to at least try. And the more you try, the luckier you get.
You also want to track your...
You guys want to know how I did so many deals when I started out? I pulled every damn government list I humanly possibly could. And it's why me and Zach give you the exact instruction. And guess what I still do to this day? We still pull the damn government list. Actually, our government list has saved our ass the last year or two. Like a lot of the traditional stuff we did, like the paid stuff, it didn't work. So, yeah. And as time goes by and as the economy gets stranger, these lists will become more and more important. So just track your results and see what you get. And then sometimes you got to change it up. Sometimes you got to pull the list more often. Sometimes you have to pull it less. Sometimes you just have to lose the list. And the only way you can do it is you got to get data. Once you get data back for, in my opinion, at least a year, then you can make a decision what you need to change. But in the beginning, you just got to try. Like, and I don't have the perfect way to do it. The thing is, you got to try to do it. I find most people that struggle with wholesaling, they talk about pulling lists and they never quite do it. Or they pull it once or twice and then they quit.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of factors in like how I do my operations since I'm technically I'm part-time, even though I still put in about...
Hey, Jay, here's the secret. Everybody does it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
The key is consistency and a lot of quantity and a lot of action. If you can put those three things together, it's really hard to fail in wholesaling. If you don't want to be consistent and you don't want to call a lot of people and stuff like that, there's nothing I can tell you to make you a better wholesaler.
Right.
And that's why I'm a firm believer. I like to watch people get their first deal. And I tell people, if you can get four more deals, you're going to make so much money in wholesaling. You have no idea. And this is how I looked at when I did my first wholesaling. And like, well, even five deals, that's not a lot. I go, if you did five, you figured out how to do it with little, no money. You navigated through the guru crap, which gurus take advantage of 75% of newbies, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that 70% of the people that go through my free wholesaling.com came from a guru? Shocking. Why? Because we track the stats. We ask them, did you pay a guru before you took this course? And 70% of them said yes. Yeah, so it just goes to show you, paying doesn't always fix your problem.
No, so. It didn't. All right. I appreciate it, Rick. Thanks.
Okay, man. Okay. Later. Okay. I had a couple questions on here. Let's see here. Fred says, Rick, how are you? Merry Christmas. You and Zach, many blessings. I appreciate that. See, it's not all business on here, man. Then I asked if I JV in Memphis. I haven't done it in a while, but Memphis got a lot of multifamily properties. So guys, as usual, if you enjoyed this live and you love talking about wholesaling, do me a favor. Make sure you smash that like button. Make sure you subscribe to the Rickin channel where we give you the truth. We give you the facts. And see, I got 21 years backing me up. I don't think I'm going anywhere, guys. And I appreciate out there. So go out and get a deal. I will be on Flip with Rick tomorrow, I believe at 1 p.m. Eastern. And then I'll be back on with Zach on Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern. So guys, go out there, get some deals. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. And that's it, guys. Have a good one. See you.